It's Eucalyptus Real Estate versus Innovative Work Comp Solutions, which is important too. Sorry. Well, forgive me, counsel. I'm ready for you. This is 23-3119 Eucalyptus Real Estate versus Innovative Work Comp Solutions. Counsel for appellant, please make your appearance and proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Sam Wallens, for the appellants, Eucalyptus Real Estate LLC and Dover Group LLC. This court should reverse the district court's entry of summary judgment for two primary reasons. The first is that the administrative services organization agreement at issue in this case is ambiguous, both patently and latently, as we've asserted in our brief. And second, that disputes of fact precluded summary judgment on the question whether the ASOA should be reformed, either for a mutual mistake or a unilateral mistake. I think the best use of my time, subject to the court's questions this morning, are on two primary issues of latent ambiguity and mutual mistake. When it comes to latent ambiguity, I think the case we've identified in our brief, the one, it's an unpublished 10th Circuit decision, but it's a correct and persuasive application of Kansas law.
Let me ask this, though. As it relates to latent ambiguity, did you point to any language that you hang your hat on to establish the basis for latent ambiguity?
We didn't point to specific language, and I don't think that's necessary.
Tell me why that's not necessary. It seems to me you're done. Most of the cases that deal with latent ambiguity have a language, and then there are external facts that cause that language to be ambiguous. And if you don't have language, then we're left to try to find it, aren't we?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily the case, and that's not what this court did in the Kahn decision either. And I think it's important to look at the language that the Kahn decision used in paragraph 5 of page 2 of the Westlaw site, that the debtor and the plaintiffs hereby discharge one against the other any and all debts, claims that they have respectively, or that they respectively have, or may claim, one against the other from the beginning of time to the date of this agreement. And on its face, I think that language is very clear. And that's an argument that the district court accepted in Kahn. But this court reversed because of the background circumstances without necessarily looking at a particular. They did find some ambiguity in the agreement, but that wasn't the language that turned on latent ambiguity. They found some patent ambiguity.
Didn't you just read to me language from Kahn that you said the court, you looked at external circumstances and found latent ambiguity?
They did look at external circumstances. I want to make sure I answer your question, Your Honor, because when it came to patent ambiguity, they identified some, but it was, I believe, in the heading of the settlement agreement that referred to the adversarial bankruptcy proceeding. It wasn't this clear language about the latent ambiguity holding, where they're saying it would just be absurd for someone in an adversarial proceeding to settle all of their claims, including the $169,000 of claims against the debtor's estate, in exchange for nothing. And I think that's really what's happening here is the construction, when it comes to the latent ambiguity doctrine, the construction of the ASOA, which only refers to Dover LLC, and we sort of can see we've identified some patent ambiguity as well, that there's a question, is it Dover LLC, is it Dover Group LLC? But for the purpose of latent ambiguity, what the district court did, and what my friends have asserted, as I understand their briefs, is that Eucalyptus and Dover entered this ASOA to have workers' compensation coverage for no one. Now, all the while, Eucalyptus has made $106,000 worth of premium payments for a defined set of workers and a defined set of class codes. And what Kahn did and what's consistent with Kansas law is once we identify that ambiguity, either latent or patent is sufficient, the answer is to go through further fact-finding. And sort of as a caveat, in Kahn, they didn't necessarily do that because the district court or bankruptcy court had already had a hearing on the question, had engaged in fact-finding. That hasn't happened here where a trial is necessary.
Well, can I just, I'm still having a hard time understanding the latent ambiguity argument and how it relates to the basic principle that if you don't have an ambiguity on the face of the agreement, you don't go to parole evidence. But here it seems like we're going to parole evidence anyway to get to a latent ambiguity. So how do you reconcile
that? I think to reconcile that, the answer is if a plain reading of the contract on its plain terms leads to absurdity, if there's no reasonable person that would have entered that contract, and then if there are background circumstances to show that that consequence or the plain text does not necessarily mean what it says, then we get to latent ambiguity. And that's, I think, what Kansas courts are talking about is even if there is a clear contract, we would never read a contract in a way that vitiates the purpose of the contract. And here, even if...
So what I'm hearing, let me make sure I've got this right. You're actually starting with an absurd results problem with the contract, and then that's leading you to background facts to find a latent ambiguity, and then that opens the door to further extrinsic evidence. Is that your argument?
I think that is, Your Honor, and I think that's exactly how this court proceeded in Kahn, was they looked at the agreement and its terms in paragraph 5 in the opinion, and they said... that this view of the agreement that the plaintiff would give up $169,000 of claims against the bankruptcy estate in exchange for nothing is absurd. And from that absurdity principle, they went to the bankruptcy court's fact-finding on the matter and said, no, we don't think that the plaintiff in this case really gave up all of his claims. We think that the plaintiff gave up his claims with respect to the adversary proceeding alone, not the $169,000 of claims that they had asserted against the estate, even in the face of the language that said all debts, claims that they may have from the time of the date of this agreement to the present day. And so that was very clear language, I think, that this court, and correctly in accordance with Kansas law, I think, looked at that absurd result, which I think is what we assert is happening here, and said that this can't possibly be the case. And so we've got to understand what's going on.
Don't you have to go to outside information to get to an absurd result?
Well, I think you do, and that's exactly what the court was talking about in Kahn, and that's what they're citing in race, I think, Steaker or Streaker from the Seventh Circuit, and said, you know, it's a unique circumstance, and we concede that there may be background facts that show what is written in this contract is not necessarily what the parties intended. And that's consistent, again, with interpreting the contract in a way that doesn't vitiate its purpose.
Interpreting the contract let me ask you one threshold question. Did you raise this latent ambiguity argument in the district court?
Well, we did raise ambiguity. There's in the pretrial order.
That won't cut it. I mean, if you're making a distinct latent ambiguity argument now, did you make a distinct latent ambiguity argument in the district court?
The pretrial order does not say latent ambiguity, Your Honor. No. I think where I would turn to on this point is that
I don't think you've answered the question yet. Did you raise it? That latent ambiguity? Did you raise it?
Well, at summary judgment, I don't think in the parties' briefs the term latent ambiguity appeared, no, in all candor, Your Honor. They did argue that the contract was ambiguous, including that the contract was patently ambiguous.
You acknowledge, that's a distinct argument, right?
It is a distinct argument, yes, okay. Your Honor. And that goes to the face of the contract and what the patent ambiguity in this contract would be, that it says Dover LLC, the signature block, the person that entered the ASOA, Mr. McGinnis, it says Dover Group LLC. And so there's the Hassan Wilkerson case that we cited from the Kansas Court of Appeals, that this sort of internal inconsistency creates a facial ambiguity. And so then we need to go to the extrinsic evidence to figure out who entered the agreement and in what capacity they entered the agreement.
Can I stop you for a quick second there? Let's assume that I give you the benefit of the notion, and I think the district court didn't find it was ambiguous at all on the patent ambiguity point, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, let's assume that we decide that that point it is ambiguous, but it's only ambiguous as it relates to Dover LLC, Dover Group. How does that help you? I mean, that's still eucalyptus is still not mentioned, and all that means is we've got to. That we're allowed to look at parole evidence to determine whether it's Dover Group or Dover LLC. You still don't prevail, right?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think where it gets us to is we find the patent ambiguity, and it gets us to the extrinsic evidence. And I think there is sufficient, there's a dispute of fact here over even just saying Dover Group LLC. What does that really mean? Because, and I think it really starts with the workers' compensation application. That's at volume 2 of the appendix at page 130. Now, that says Dover LLC, but it has an NCCI risk ID number. And that ID number is 913616626. And if you go back to the NCCI's combinability determination in volume 3 of the appendix at page 103, that shows the same risk ID number that's combining Dover LLC and Eucalyptus Real Estate as combinable entities for the purpose of experience rating because they have common ownership. And so in that application, you have the first signal that Eucalyptus and Dover Group or Dover LLC are looking to obtain workers' compensation coverage for both entities. And then most clearly, I think it's the most clear dispute of fact is Mr. Presko's November 26th email where he says, does this cover Eucalyptus also? I believe the majority of the payroll comes out of Eucalyptus. We think, and we assert, Mr. Knight's response was clear. I understand my friends are saying it is not so clear, but Mr. Knight responds generally that coverage is extended to the employees reported each month to the program. If a client has common ownership with another company and reports those under Dover LLC for this program, they're covered if properly classified.
Now, counsel, you finally have got to the point that what's bothering me as to the question whether it was a mutual mistake or a unilateral mistake. As I understand, that's what you're arguing right now.
That's where we're getting to, yes, okay. Your Honor.
The problem that I have, they're here on summary judgment. You look at that message that was sent by the company's own agent as to whether or not there's coverage. The district court lately, at the time of summary judgment, mm-hmm. determines on the base, because the agent does a about face, that it wasn't a mutual mistake, it was a unilateral mistake. Now, that gives me concern about, and when we're at summary judgment, whether or not that did not create a factual issue. Now, I'm going to ask opposing counsel that same question, because that to me is where this case stands.
Yes, Your Honor, and I agree, and I think...
I didn't expect you to agree. I'm just telling you where I am.
Well, sure, and what I would offer on that point, and we, I think, raised this in our brief as well, that it wasn't just the district court's reference to Mr. Knight's testimony, acceptance of it as sort of misapplying Rule 56's standards, but the case, primary case we relied on mutual mistake is Atkinson versus Darling, which I think is really factually on all fours in this case. And in fact, what the Kansas Supreme Court says in that case is when you have parties asserting there's a mutual mistake, you can't look at the other side's after-the-fact testimony that says, no, I knew what this said all along, as they're taking an advantageous position. And I think that's precisely what Mr. Knight's deposition testimony refers to. That in Atkinson, I think the agreement was also clear. There was an incentive to lease property for 5 years. It was 100 acres. The plaintiffs intended to split the property, 60 acres and 40 acres, retain 40 acres themselves. That provision never made it into the agreement. But for at least 1 year, the plaintiffs and the defendants farmed the area 40 in a 40-60 split. And at the end of the first year, the defendant comes back and says, I'm going to farm all 100 acres, and the plaintiffs object, and he says, read the lease. And that's essentially what I understand my friends are saying here, is this ASOA doesn't cover eucalyptus because it just says Dober LLC when the party's course of conduct, even for 5 months after they entered the ASOA, clearly was indicative. Eucalyptus was reporting its employees. It was reporting, there's evidence to support a finding that in the fourth quarter of 2018, Eucalyptus submitted a Form 941.
Counsel, can I just jump in and ask you, for purposes of mutual mistake, I'm understanding how that works. The ASOA, which doesn't have eucalyptus, that would be a mistake in the ASOA. So far, so good?
Yes, Your Honor.
Don't you need to show that there was an antecedent agreement that eucalyptus was covered? And it seems to me you're getting into the facts that post-agreement. But it's really, didn't there have to be an agreement, mutual agreement before, and then a mistake in the ASOA? Isn't that what you need to show?
Yes, Your Honor. I see I've run out of time, if I could try and quickly respond. I think as it relates to an antecedent agreement, what I'd point to is first the workers' compensation application that we refer to that has that NCCI risk ID number. The second antecedent agreement is Mr. Presco's November 26th email and Mr. Knight's response. And we talked a little bit about that, about Mr. Knight's after-the-fact testimony, but when it comes to mutual mistake, I think those factors show at least an intent for Eucalyptus and Dover on the one hand and Innovative on the other to include all of the parties in the ASOA. And then you have the ultimate ASOA that does not reflect the parties. If there are no further, I see I've run out of time. If there are no further questions, Your Honor.
Yeah, thank you.
May it please the court. My name is James Maloney. I represent the appellees Innovative Work Comp Solutions, LLC, INVO, PEO, Inc. 2, and United Wisconsin Insurance Company. I'd like to get started talking about the Kahn case, because I think this latent ambiguity argument is taking us down some strange rabbit holes. And I'll begin by stating that no, the latent ambiguity argument was not raised at the district court. I will point out that the gentleman here was not counsel for the appellants at that time. So that was not necessarily on him, but the effect is the same, I think. As to Kahn, I think the comments of Judge Holmes and Judge Matheson were kind of leading in the right direction, in that Kahn did not say, if there is a strange result, there must be a latent ambiguity. That's putting the cart before the horse and doing it backwards. Instead, what the court said in Kahn is we have this language, which Judge Holmes was talking about. The word is claims. What does claims mean? Well, sometimes the word claims is clear. And if it wasn't clear on its face, that would be a patent ambiguity. In this situation, we have to look at outside facts to know that claims isn't entirely clear, because there's adversarial claims and there's claims against a bankruptcy estate. And only when you add in that background context does it generate a latent ambiguity. It is not the strange result that leads to that ambiguity. It's that strange result that aided the court in resolving that latent ambiguity. But the ambiguity still had to exist in the first place. We do not have that here. The only actual ambiguity potentially in this contract relates to Dover or Dover Group. And there is no, and let's keep in mind here that the purpose of the law in resolving ambiguous contracts is to find a reasonable interpretation. There is no reasonable interpretation of the ambiguity between Dover and Dover Group that leads to the conclusion that Eucalyptus is the party to this contract. There is no way to get there.
I know where you're coming from on the latent ambiguity, and I understand that, but the second part of what you were just pointing out, where you have the question of mutual mistake or unilateral mistake, where that's his point, that the agent, when asked, you know, okay, now Eucalyptus is not part of this group, but are they going to have coverage? Now, I'm using my own language in regard to that. And the question is, from the insurance agent, is that I believe if you turn over all the records and of the employees of Eucalyptus and everything in there, that yes, there would be coverage. Then you fast forward to the actual summary judgment proceedings, and then that same agent backtracks, or at least that's the argument in regards to that, saying that, no, I didn't mean that there was going to be coverage from there. That, at the summary judgment stage, in my mind, creates a material issue of fact. Was, were they covered or were they not?
Okay. I think there's a couple parts that I'd like to address in that question.
Go right at it.
As to ambiguity, I don't think we ever get to this email, because if the contract is not ambiguous as to whether Eucalyptus is covered on its face or with some sort of latent ambiguity, then we don't consider extrinsic evidence. But what I think what you're getting to, Judge, is the reformation issue. Should this be reformed because somehow these emails expressed an intent of the parties that Eucalyptus would be a party? There's a couple of things I would keep in mind on that. Number one, it is the appellant's burden to prove with clear and convincing evidence that that was, in fact, the intent of the parties. And number two, I'll say it for Tim Knight's part. Tim Knight was the innovative employee who sent the email. That email is not the model of clarity. I think the same thing that can be said about Mr. Presco's email. It's not the model of clarity. He asks, would this cover Eucalyptus also? Maybe he's interested in getting coverage for Eucalyptus. Maybe he's interested in avoiding paying premiums based on whoever Eucalyptus employs. That's not expressed one way or the other in this document. And the only way you can form a conclusion about what he intended with that question is to look at his after-the-fact statements, which, if we're going to ignore the after-the-fact statement of Mr. Knight, we should be ignoring it from Mr. Presco as well. That's part one. I think part two of this is that the law says, first, there has to be an antecedent agreement. There was no agreement formed in that email. There was no agreement formed in the application. There was no antecedent agreement reached other than Dover LLC wants coverage. And there was no mistake in preparing the written contract because Dover LLC is who was included. More importantly, as to that exchange of emails, the law says this: an agreement must have been reached. A court will not reform an insurance contract to conform to the party's negotiations or haphazardly expressed intentions. Now, in that quote, it's an insurance contract. I think we're just talking about contract law here, so I don't think that makes a difference. At best, what we have in those exchanges of emails is haphazardly expressed intentions. And so even if there is a dispute as to what was meant by those haphazardly expressed intentions, the law says the contracts cannot be reformed to conform to those haphazardly expressed intentions.
Thanks, counsel.
Let me go back to the patent ambiguity argument. And this is what I understood opposing counsel to be saying. That there is an ambiguity as it relates to Dover LLC and Dover Group. What I suggested to opposing counsel was, well, that's the only ambiguity, and therefore Eucalyptus is not a part of this. What I understood in the retort was that, well, once you start looking at that ambiguity, that will lead you invariably to Eucalyptus, because then you look at the application, and then the application will have the combining parties number. And so I guess my question to you is that right? I mean, what's wrong with that? If I understood him correctly, that's the argument he's making, that once you open that door to the Dover LLC, Dover Group ambiguity, you invariably will get to Eucalyptus.
Well, I think the answer is, in short, and I'll expound on this, but you're trying to resolve the ambiguity, if there is one, between Dover LLC and Dover Group LLC. That doesn't open up a world of all potential explanations or interpretations. You've got, because when we talk about an ambiguity, that is, something in the contract can have two meanings. We need to figure out what the right one is. It doesn't mean we start searching for all kinds of other meanings that might be buried over here or over there. It's, there's two meanings here. which one is correct.
And the application actually referred to Dover LLC, right?
That's correct.
And so if you resolve the ambiguity of Dover LLC and Dover Group and say, okay, it is Dover Group, then you still got this additional step to decide what, how do you resolve the Dover LLC ambiguity in the application, right?
Well, the application is not the contract. I think if the assumption is we're going to resolve that there's an ambiguity between Dover and Dover Group, and then the assumption is we're going to resolve that and say what it means is Dover Group. The problem is that doesn't mean that Dover Group includes employees of Eucalyptus. Dover Group had no employees. And what we end up with is a contract where, let's say we plug in the word Dover Group in place of Dover in the ASO agreement. What we have is a contract that says Dover Group is going to pay based on its number of employees, and Innovative is going to provide coverage that applies to those employees. Well, there are no employees. So the result of that is Dover Group isn't required to pay anything, and Innovative's not required to provide any coverage. And that result, that Dover Group isn't required to pay anything, is exactly what my client tried to accomplish by refunding the money. It saw these are all Dover employees or Dover Group employees, and so it sent the money back. Now, I do want to comment on the combinability. That was raised in one of the questions. I believe it was from Judge Holmes. That, quite honestly, I think that's a red herring. What that document does, and I think the court addressed this in its Team Industries opinion that was cited. Actually, I think in the summary judgment motion, we cited the district court, and then it was decided right around the time we were briefing this appeal, but it is in there. But what I think that means, or what I'm confident that means, is these are two entities. Their businesses are related enough, they have common ownership, they're doing kind of the same thing, that for someone trying to assess the risk of insuring one of them, you can look at the loss history for both of them. You know, it's kind of like a credit score. If you don't have, if you've never had credit, you're not going to have a good credit score. You have to have done things in order to get that score so that people can assess the risk of loaning to you. Same thing here. They want a bigger loss history. And so what they do is they go get combined for purposes of that experience rating, but that's the only purpose of it, is the experience rating. It does not mean that anytime Dover Group is used, it also includes Eucalyptus. It does not mean that anytime Eucalyptus is used, it also includes Dover Group. And it doesn't make employees of one into employees of another. The sole purpose of that is to assess the risk of writing to one or the other of them by using the loss history of both. As to the reformation argument, I think what we get back to is there was no mutual mistake here. There was no antecedent agreement. There's no mistake when you look at the ASO agreement that you can point to and says this does not reflect the agreement that was made. We've also seen this argument that there was a unilateral mistake, which I believe, based on my review, was raised on appeal for the first time also as a basis for reformation. But as to unilateral mistake, there's a few cases cited, and this case is totally different than those. In this case, Innovative prepared a contract document based on the application that was submitted to it. And it was never told, and no one ever agreed, this is also going to apply to Eucalyptus. In the cases that are cited in support of the unilateral mistake theory, it was the party opposing reformation that had created the mistake in the first place. So, for example, one of the cases that's cited was an insurance case where the insurance company or its agent had stamped the date of a payment wrong, and that date became the date the policy was effective. Well, and that was no good for the person trying to get the insurance because they had a loss prior to that date. But it was the insurance company who opposed reformation. And so the court looked to unilateral mistake in that situation because it was the party opposing reformation who had made that mistake. That's not our situation here. In one of the other reformation cases that's cited for unilateral mistake, there was a real estate sale. The At this point, I don't remember purchaser or buyer, but that's beside the point, because that person went to their lawyer after they agreed this is the parcel of land that's being sold, and had their attorney add language to it that made that piece of land bigger. Then they took it back to the other party. It was sold, I guess, by the seller, and then the dispute arose, and they applied the unilateral mistake theory because it was the party who created the error, the party who created the problem, who was opposing the reformation. It wasn't, as in this case, the party that created the problem who was trying to seek reformation. This all started with an application that was submitted for something called Dover LLC. My client gave a contract to Dover LLC. It did exactly what was asked of it. And so there's no basis here for unilateral mistake reformation, nor for mutual mistake reformation, when the only thing we can point to is, at best, haphazardly expressed intentions. That concludes my comments. I'm happy to answer any further questions the court might have.
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Minute and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I can be brief. I think what I'd like to just follow up on, there's a conversation about Mr. Prescott's email and Mr. Knight's response. I think that just underscores the disputes of fact that were inappropriate for summary judgment in this case, particularly on the mutual mistake issue. And to follow up on the mutual mistake issue, there are two cases we've cited that have rejected sort of the argument that my friends are making here, in the sense that mutual mistake is unavailable if it is the party claiming mutual mistake's own fault for the mutual mistake.
Well, he was talking about unilateral mistake.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that's true in Slattery versus Ibarra for the mutual mistake, but also you'll find it in Andres versus Clausen, which is a case that we briefed. That's a unilateral mistake case.
And on the unilateral mistake front, opposing counsel says that you didn't raise that below. That's also at least my initial reading of the record. I mean, do you disagree with that?
Well, I think I don't disagree that unilateral mistake plus inequitable conduct was not said below, but I think what we're talking about here is what is the proper construction of Kansas law, because when we look at the pretrial order, there is a claim for declaratory relief for reformation. And in the defendant's defenses, I think it's paragraph 4B3, they defend both in terms of mutual mistake and unilateral mistake. And in that paragraph, they say unilateral mistake and fraud. But as even I think the district court order here noted, that mutual mistake exists when there's antecedent agreement, a misunderstanding, and then an agreement that does not express the party's intentions in the absence of fraud or other inequitable conduct. And so I do think there's a basis for unilateral mistake and inequitable conduct in the record, Your Honor.
All right, but I hear it being discussed in the record, but did you argue that? I mean, inequitable conduct and unilateral mistake. I mean, that's a big difference. I mean, the question was the court alerted to the fact that you wanted relief under that theory?
Yes, and so the theory below was that there was a fraud or promissory estoppel conduct, and the district court initially held that waived and then went to the merits of it as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right. That's the last case for this morning. Again, sorry, counsel. We certainly was attentive to your issue. Case is submitted, and we will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow.